Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
There are several criminal matters this week that are very interesting, and I had to get you on, Damon. The gag order in the Idaho College murder case. There is a golf cart death, really freak accident with footballer John Elway, and I'm going to be talking to you about that, and DOJ lawyers quitting in droves and what that means. Damon Chironis is one of the best criminal defense lawyers in Chicago, founder of Chironis and Parente. He's an advocate for people. Federal, white-collar, violent crimes, drug and sex crimes. He's been involved in some of the highest-profile cases across the country, including the representation of film mogul Harvey Weinstein. Thank you so much for joining us. And how is the Cubs game? Are you coming out of it now?
Yeah, they came in second, it looks like. the Red Sox put up some serious runs in the late innings, but we're still having a great year.
That's good. And you made it without a rain delay. That's good.
Yes.
Let's start with the tragic golf cart accident in California. This wasn't a huge news story, but it brings up some issues that I hear a lot of people talk about. John Elway, who's an NFL Hall of Fame player, is driving a golf cart with his longtime friend, Jeff Spierback. He was riding in back. Jeff falls off. He hits his head and he dies. This week, the authorities say they're not going to charge Elway. Can you tell us a little bit about when a tragic accident turns into something where criminal charges are brought?
Yes, whenever, you know, a death is involved in a motor vehicle accident or a golf cart accident, you know, there's going to be an investigation. The first thing, as you probably would guess, that they're going to look at is whether or not the driver of the vehicle was under the influence of alcohol or drugs. I mean, that's where they start. Because if in Illinois you're under the influence, and even if you're not at fault, and somebody dies. In other words, if you're driving under the influence and somebody blows a red light and hits your car and somebody in that car dies, you can be charged with reckless homicide just for being under the influence. So, you know, that's the first thing they look at. And it, apparently they ruled that out. And then after that, you know, what the police do is they look at other forms of reckless conduct. And I don't think anybody would have thought this was intentional. But if somebody's going too quickly or flying down the street or doing something in a reckless manner, you know, they can be charged with certain crimes. Here, they did an investigation, and, you know, sometimes an accident is just that. It's just an accident, and they decided there were no charges that were appropriate.
And is there, you know, it's, apparently Elway was friends with this guy for 35 years, and they were really, really good friends, not just business friends, but personal friends. Does that matter, do you think, when an investigator is looking into this? Obviously, like you said, maybe there's no drugs or alcohol. He wasn't going at an excessive speed. There was nothing reckless, really, and certainly nothing intentional. How does it play in when a person, you know, has a close relationship or even a familial relationship with somebody who gets killed?
Sure. At the end of the day, if there's no evidence of a crime, you know, a family that wants charges to be pressed could not be successful in doing that. But I can certainly tell you there are situations where the police or the state's attorney may not want to charge a case, and a family really pushes for it, and the state or the police will press charges. Mm-hmm. So family members, victims of crimes or alleged victims of crimes, as the case may be, definitely have some pull. And the same thing is true if a victim or a family member doesn't want to go through with something. Karen, you've been in domestic violence court. You've seen it happen.
Yep.
You've seen, you know, victims of domestic violence show up in court and say, I don't want to continue with the prosecution. So victims have, and victims' family do have, you know, an important say in it. But if there's just nothing there, right, the police aren't going to charge or the state's not going to charge just because a victim, you know, wants something done.
And that doesn't stop civil lawsuits from being brought in any way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. And in a case like this, you know, there may not have been, you know, any sort of criminality involved, but there may have been negligence. There may have been something that's sort of a lower standard. As you know, in civil cases, they could say, well, look, he was driving the car too fast, or he didn't take proper precautions, and that was negligent. And that could lead to significant, you know, civil penalties and a monetary, you know, judgment if they go down that road.
And I would say, you know, it's interesting. I have a house up in Wisconsin, and I know two people this summer who fell off golf carts and were hurt, you know, not horribly badly. But, you know, it just seems like something that people should be more careful of because, you know, you're riding around. There's, you know, maybe no restraints. You know, you're maybe drinking around in the sun. It's bumpy.
Drinking's usually involved, right? I mean, right. When you're out, I don't golf, you know.
Neither do I.
I've never done, but I know a lot of my friends do, and when I meet them after a golf match, they're usually walking sideways. So I think, you know, oftentimes drinking is involved with that, and you got to take precautions. If you're riding a bike and you're under the influence, bad things can happen.
Absolutely. Let's go to this issue of the DOJ lawyers quitting. I saw a statistic. I was just really shocked by it, and I don't want to get into politics at all. It's a no-win situation, and I know my listeners all have their views, and they can keep their views, but I'm going to just try to maybe explain the significance of these things rather than go to the political part of it. The media is reporting that two-thirds of all DOJ lawyers who are tasked with defending the administration's actions have quit. Okay, and so these are the people who are defending maybe executive orders and the firing of different administrative heads, etc. Damon, you deal with federal prosecutors and the DOJ all the time when you defend cases that are political in nature or drug dealing or gang-related activities. Do you see it's normal that you have this many people who are quitting their jobs? Is this just a change in administration and this happens all the time?
You know, I don't think it's normal. I've never heard of it to this extent. And maybe that's in part because of all of the other things that are going on in our country right now. But I know, without mentioning any names, I know prosecutors who have left that office. And when I would ask why, they'd say, read the news. I mean, that's happened. And I think, you know, the problem is, and forget political lines, right? And, you know, at the end of the day, the United States Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, is supposed to be independent. And I'm not saying that when other presidents of other parties were in office, there weren't similar issues. But I think here, a lot of prosecutors feel like they've lost that independence, and they don't want to be involved in this administration. And whether they're right or wrong, I think that's part of it. They are sort of thinking that their job is to uphold the Constitution, and although the president is their boss, there has historically been a separation between the commander-in-chief and the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I think a lot of U.S. attorneys, probably along political lines, are just leaving. That doesn't mean they're right. That doesn't mean they're wrong. But I think it's definitely a direct result of what looks like, you know, a significant taking over of the Department of Justice and, you know, basically saying, hey, you work for me now. And some of the U.S. attorneys are saying, well, we're not going to do that.
And, you know, I've heard, you know, some anonymous interviews where people are saying, hey, listen, I have got a law license. And if I'm being asked to defend things, I mean, listen, we all defend things that are, you know, you represent people who you know are guilty, you know, represent people who are not guilty, or represent people who are maybe guilty of something but not what they're being charged with. We have to zealously advocate for our clients. There's no question about that. But what you can't do is make up facts. What you can't do is argue law that doesn't exist. Do you think there's some of that that's going into these decisions where they're being asked to take positions that might be against their ethical code?
I think so. I mean, I think prosecutors have a unique role in the justice system. You know, defense attorneys like myself, we have to uphold the Constitution. We have to do, you know, things ethically. But prosecutors have such a powerful job. And, you know, the Supreme Court has said they have a unique role in our judicial system. And I think, you know, you look at the Eric Adams case in New York, where a number of high-level U.S. attorneys refused to be involved in that. And some of them were fired, some of them left. And, you know, there's some really strong letters of resignation that were written saying, look, this isn't my job. My job is to uphold the Constitution. My job is to zealously prosecute when it's necessary and not to be involved in politics. And, you know, I thought, whether I agree with those politics or not, you know, everybody should read some of those letters that were written because they really sort of describe what I think prosecutors' roles are. So, yes, I absolutely think some of the prosecutors who have left are just saying, look, this is not what I signed up for. I don't agree with this. And they have every right to quit and do something else. But the problem is you lose good prosecutors. And the more good prosecutors you lose, the less effective your office is going to be in prosecuting significant crimes. And that's something that I think we're seeing, where really good prosecutors with institutional knowledge are sort of saying, look, I've had enough. And that's a problem, I think, nationwide.
Damon, where can people contact you if they have a serious criminal problem?
The best way to get in touch with me is just to go on my website. There's contact information there. It's www.sharonislaw.com. Easiest way.
And you can always email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com, and I'm happy to give you all the contact information for any guest that I have mentioned on the show. And while we're plugging all kinds of things, Damon, you are a musician on the side. You are a frustrated musician who just happens to practice law, and you're really good at it. So what is this event that you're coming up?
For a guitarist, I'm a very good lawyer, Karen. That's what I tell people. But, yeah, we've got a big show August 23rd at the fundraiser at St. Vincent's in River Forest. We're playing with Jeff Morrow and the Jewel Bags. You know, Jeff was a star on Top Chef and all that stuff.
Yes.
So it's August 23rd, 6:30, in sunny River Forest. It's a great cause, and it should be a really good night.
That sounds great. Okay, don't quit your day job. Okay, here we go. Damon,
believe me.
Your wife wouldn't let you do that, I don't think.
No.
Knowing her, I don't think so. Let's talk about this Idaho murder case. This is the case of the four Idaho college students who were horribly stabbed and killed in their off-campus residence. The defendant finally, right at the beginning, when trial was just going to start, he pled guilty this month. The deal is he gets four life sentences plus 10 years, and he waives his right to appeal. Wednesday, the case is set for sentencing. So let's take this step by step, Damon. This week, the judge lifted the gag order. There was a gag order on the players here. Is a gag order a normal thing in any criminal case, or is it just in the high profile cases? And tell us what the judge has to balance and what the judge has to weigh in determining whether there is going to be a gag order.
Sure, I'll start with that. You know, the judge has to weigh someone's First Amendment rights to speak and to say things. You know, we have a pretty, you know, extensive rights to speak our minds in this country, at least now. And, you know, you have to weigh that against the right to a fair trial, the right to not infect the jury from either side. So that's really the balancing act. What you don't want is lawyers trying the case in the media, although we all try to do it. And, you know, I've been involved in cases where there have been gag orders, but that's really the balancing act. You know, the judge has one job: to ensure that there's a fair trial, to ensure that the decision by anyone is made in the courtroom. So that's one of the main reasons that you put a gag order forward. And sometimes cases have such, you know, salacious evidence or things like that, that you don't want it seeping out in the public before the trial.
So I saw that the city of Moscow, which is where the crimes were committed, it announced it was going to create a website for the documents that were involved in the investigation. Now, this, you know, there are, my understanding, Damon, is that there were multiple bodies who were involved. As we remember, you know, the state police were involved, the county police, the university police, the FBI was involved. I think Washington State had people investigating. So when you have these websites now that are going to be created where people can actually go on and look at the documents, what are we going to see? Apparently, the judge announced that he needed to go through the documents and to redact or remove certain information. What kind of information do you think the judge is going to remove, and what is going to be available to the public?
Okay. Well, first, I just want to answer one of the earlier questions. It's usually only in these high-profile cases where you get the gag orders, because that's where the news is covering them. So that's one of the things I forgot to mention. You know, the judge said they're going to go through it and put forward certain documents. I don't expect there to be sort of a file dump. He's going to have to redact quite a bit of information. A lot of names are going to be redacted. Any identifying information. I don't expect them to get, you know, you're not going to get grand jury transcripts. What they're probably going to get are police reports that have been heavily, heavily redacted. And there may be a fight over that later to get reports that are not redacted. But just because the case is done does not mean that everything is sort of up for grabs. There are still documents that need to be protected. Again, grand jury, there's secrecy involved in those. I don't expect, hopefully, that the crime scene photos will be leaked. I know that was something, you know, some people have been asking about. You know, the families of these victims certainly don't deserve that. I don't think they'd ever want those photos on the internet. So I think those hopefully will not get leaked and those will be safe. But you're going to get police reports. You may get, you know, some of the witness statements with redacted names. So you have to guess who said what. But that's sort of what I expect to be released in a case like this.
And everyone here is talking about motive. And again, you know, you have said this over and over again, having represented many criminal defendants, that sometimes there is no motive, that someone is just plain mean, just evil. You know, that what was the line from Bruce Springsteen that you quote?
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess my question is going to be, what, if anything, might be in these files that might shed light on what this guy was thinking about by killing these beautiful young people who with whom he really did not have a relationship?
Sure. I think what might be in there is the extent of the investigation to uncover the amount of planning that went into this. That's something that could shed some light on it. You know, they've probably done, you know, forensic discovery on all of his phones, laptops, those things. You're going to maybe see search terms, things along those lines that may help develop why he did this, or at least the extent of the planning. So I think that's something that would be interesting to see if that gets released.
And the sentencing is probably a fait accompli. I mean, he pled guilty. The deal from the prosecutors was, you know, 4 life sentences and 10 years and no right to appeal. Is there any possibility that a judge is going to reject it and do something else?
Not at this point. I mean, really, the state took death off the table. At this point, it's exactly what you said, a fait accompli. And that's doesn't mean that the victim impact statements don't need to be read or spoken about. We can talk about that. But no, I think this is the deal. It's going through. The judge has already, I think, accepted it. And now it's just a matter of meeting out the agreed to sentence.
And as far as the victim impact statements, you've been in court when these things have been read. I assume you expect them to be very emotional and probably a lot of anger.
Absolutely. And victim impact statements, so the listeners know, is, you know, before a judge enters sentence, you can hear from family members of, you know, surviving family members of the victims. And if you don't have a plea agreement or if there is an undetermined sentence, victim impact statements can be very, very important. And I've seen them sway judges to sometimes give higher sentences. In a case like this, where essentially he's getting 4 life sentences, there's not much that's going to change, but it does give the victims the opportunity and their family members to confront for the last time and for the first time the person who killed their loved ones. And, you know, that's part of some form of closure for them. I don't want to say it's cathartic, but it, you know, I've seen victim impact statements where family members scream at defendants, or they forgive them. I've seen family members forgive defendants in cases. So you really never know what you're going to see, but it's going to be very emotional, it's going to be very dramatic, and it's going to be very sad.
Now, the defendant has a right to speak, does he not?
Yes, he has the right to allocute. Every defendant has a right to allocution, to say something before judgment is passed.
And do you think he's going to? And if you were his lawyer, would you tell him to do it?
You know, in a situation like this, it's really up to him. I have told clients before in cases that I've lost that we think we have a good issue on appeal, don't say too much because, you know, we don't want you to get, you know, sort of hurt your appeal down the road if you make some admission. But here, he has no appeals. I don't know if he's going to say anything. He could apologize, and he could say something horrible, God forbid. You know, we've seen that happen. I've never seen that, you know, necessarily live, but we've seen enough of these true crime shows where convicted killers have said things to the families to provoke them. So, you know, who knows what he's going to say. He may say nothing, and that might be the best route to go.
And whatever he says is not really going to impact how he's treated during his incarceration for the rest of his young life, right? I mean, the judges aren't going to take that into account when it comes to how he's treated.
No, I mean, once you're sentenced and sent off, it's really up to the Bureau of Prisons to decide your treatment. It's almost like its own government. So last time, he's probably going to be in some sort of special housing unit or protective custody. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he says nothing, but I'm certainly interested to see.
Yeah, and my guess is he's saying nothing. And, you know, I think people like him, just, you know, knowing a little bit about the people who have these tendencies, I will say, there's a little arrogance and there's a little feeling of power that they have. This is the only power they're ever going to have. We saw that with the Highland Park shooter, you know, just letting the case go until the very bitter end and then pleading guilty at the last minute, you know, just basically holding on to that power. And, you know, my expectations are that he's not going to say anything, but we will see on Wednesday. Damon,
we will see.
Thank you so much for joining us. And also, can you give one plug to your event coming up?
August 23rd in River Forest at St. Vincent's Fair Church in the big toy where I got a lot of detentions when I was a kid, 6:30 to 10:30.
There you go. Damon, thank you so much for joining us. Have a good rest of your afternoon.